But I have to admit that I could have taken that in many different ways. Another man might have self-executed right then and there. After all, that's what Graves and Leeson had just done. Instead, I moved down the only path I could think of that might save all of us. Nagata shook his head, staring into space.
Such hubris. Such risk-taking. It is inconceivable that an individual like you was placed in that kind of position. You held the lives of billions in your hands.
And he didn't hesitate, Tribune Drusus said, suddenly re-entering the conversation. He took bold action, which turned out to be the correct choice. Nagata kept shaking his head.
Insanity. I should by all rights move to disband your outfit, Drusus. People at Central have been saying so for years.
Use us instead, Drusus said. Why destroy your toughest unit in the face of an interstellar war?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe because you helped start this war,
Nagata shouted the last part of his sentence at us.
Again,
Drusus said calmly.
I ask that you use us, Equestrian. Place us where we'll be most useful.
Nagata glared at Drusus, but then he began to nod slowly after a few seconds. His sudden anger appeared to dissipate.
Very well. I know exactly where to deploy your legion of outcasts, Drusus. You'll serve us yet, even if your murderous specialist here doesn't feel like it.
Chapter 5. I bedded down that night on cold puffcrete in the sub-basement under the tram station. This part of the mustering hall was dank and dimly lit. Most people didn't even know it existed. Overhead, the trams rumbled and squealed all night long. Various people from my unit, as well as many others, filtered in and found a spot to camp nearby, but they barely looked at me. Carlos didn't show up as I'd expected him to, maybe because he hadn't bothered to look for me. Others wandered by, and I recognized some of them, but they didn't stop to talk to me either. The word must be out. Specialist James McGill was to be avoided at all costs. I was bad news, and somehow everyone knew it. I was in a bit of a blue mood myself. Camping out in the cavernous sub-basement was quite a come-down from the pricey hotel where I'd spent my previous night. There wasn't any beer to be had and precious little food. Once we'd reported in down here, we weren't allowed to go back up into the mustering hall proper, where we could at least buy a burger. We were informed that we were shipping out at dawn, and that we'd best shut the hell up and stay put in the meantime. When a familiar face did finally find me, it was late. Most troopers were snoring, and I'd joined them. A kick in the ribs alerted me that I wasn't alone. I rolled to my feet and stared at my assailant.
"Is that a snarl I see on your face, McGill?"
Veteran Harris asked. He looked amused, and his fists were on his hips. His eyes were tight and serious despite his light tone. He wasn't happy with me. He rarely was. Veteran Harris was a big black guy who was as mean as cat dirt. He was an experienced soldier and the most senior non-com in my unit, but he'd never quite gotten used to my style.
"Oh, it's you, Vet," I said. "Come to tuck me in?"
"That's right. Me and my friends want to talk things over with you."
I glanced over my shoulder. Sure enough, three more veterans stood behind me with their arms crossed. They wore Varus patches, all of them. This made my heart sink a little. I couldn't pull any crap on them about not being under their command. All of these men were from my outfit, and they had every right to give me an order.
"What's this about, Vet?"
I asked, nonchalantly, even though I figured I already knew. Veteran Harris and I had never quite seen eye to eye. In fact, he'd killed me a few times, and I'd returned the favor in my own way. When we were both in the path of a real enemy, we'd always fought back to back. But if we were on our own time, well, we just didn't get along.
"We We want you to refuse your advancement to candidacy, Harris said, coming right out with it.
Why would I do that, Vet?
Because we don't think you're ready yet for that kind of responsibility.
With all due respect, I disagree, I said.
One of the men behind me jabbed me in the left kidney at that moment. It was a sharp blow, not full force, but it was enough to hurt pretty bad, and it kind of pissed me off. I grunted, but didn't fall to my knees. I didn't even turn around.
You want to do this right now?
I asked Harris. Harris's face clouded in momentary confusion.
Do what?
The test. The trial. Whatever hokum you've come up with to determine if a man is ready to be a veteran or not.
As I said this, I stood at attention and clasped my hands behind my back.
Maybe beating on a man from behind is part of your hazing routine, I said.
I reached into my back pocket and retrieved my combat knife. I didn't draw it out into the open. The sub-basement wasn't pitch dark, but it was pretty near. The only light was shining into my face from a few scattered lanterns. As long as I kept the knife behind my back, I was pretty sure the guys standing behind me wouldn't see it.
I don't think you're getting the message, McGill, Harris said.
I kept my hands behind my back and angled the blade of my knife toward the man behind me. I smiled at Veteran Harris.
I don't think I am, I said. But I'm ready, and I'll take your best shot with my hands behind my back. How's that?
Harris got into my face.
Are you threatening me, Specialist? I think you're threatening me.
No, Vet, I just don't get it. Why don't you ladies explain it to me?
This last I tossed over my shoulder toward the man behind me. A fist was driven at my back again in immediate response, targeting my right kidney this time. It came in harder, which was bad for the guy throwing the punch. I'd gambled dangerously this time. That punch could have come at another spot, for instance, but I had calculated that it wouldn't. This guy seemed fascinated with kidney punches. He could have gone at the left kidney again, but I'd guessed he'd go after the right since his first shot to the left had failed to knock me down. An odd screeching sound came to my ears after I took that second punch in the back.
"What the hell is wrong with you, Johnson?"
Harris demanded.
"My fingers! Two of them are off!"
Harris snapped his eyes to mine. He nodded appreciatively. I was still standing, and there was blood all over the knife behind me. Fortunately, it was another man's blood.
"We're not hogs," Harris said dangerously. "We're your superiors."
"I know that, Vet," I said. "That's why you're still on your feet."
Harris threw up his arms in disgust.
"All right, fine. You want to go for it, don't you? I don't know why I bothered to try to explain things to you. I'm some kind of kind-hearted fool. I tried to come here and give you a friendly warning. I tried to do the right thing for a man I fought shoulder to shoulder with. What you don't understand is that this isn't about you being a good fighter, McGill. We all know you can fight. We just don't think you're ready to lead men into battle. As Varus veterans, it's our responsibility to make that call. Do you understand what I'm saying?"
"I hear you loud and clear, Vet," I said.
Veteran Harris sighed and stalked away into the night.
"Pick up your damn fingers, Johnson," I heard him say, "and quit that whining."
After they left me, I settled down using my ruck as a pillow on that hard, cold floor. I closed my eyes, crossed my arms, and pretended to fall asleep again. But I didn't sleep. I couldn't stop thinking about this trial and what it might entail. I got the feeling it wasn't going to involve a multiple-choice test and a good-natured round of arm wrestling. Still, I was more determined than ever to get through it. Call it a character flaw, but when people told me I wasn't good enough for something, well, I tended to get stubborn about it. I just had to prove them wrong. Chapter 6. We were rousted out of our sleeping bags before the sun rose the next day. Hustling aboard early morning trams, we were sent rattling down the tracks to the spaceport. There, waiting for us under the pink skies of dawn, we found a long line of lifters. I shuffled aboard the closest one, and less than an hour later, flew up into space. None of these events were new to me. I'd been deployed on alien planets several times before, and on each occasion I'd been shipped off into space to travel to the target world. This time, however, I had no idea where we were going, or who we were supposed to fight. But come to think of it, that part wasn't all that unusual either. The only surprising element of the new campaign was the sight of two more ships following Minotaur in space. In the past, the Legion had always flown out aboard a single Dreadnought-class ship, a starship capable of warp drive. One ship, one Legion. That was how it had always been. This time, instead of one Dreadnought, there were three. We found our bunks, and before we could stretch out on them, Minotaur entered a warp bubble. We were quickly propelled right out of the solar system. At that first morning roll call the next day, I raised my hand to ask Centurion Graves about the other ships. "Sir?" I asked when he reluctantly called on me.
"What is it, McGill?"
"Why are there two other ships following Minotaur, sir? Are we headed out with three legions this time?"
"Close," he said. "There are two full legions on this trip, Varus and Solstice. In addition, we have a third ship with extra equipment and an auxiliary cohort for each legion."
I frowned at this answer. I recalled the Solstice regular who'd yelled at me at the smart door yesterday. It made sense that Solstice was going with us, as they'd been visible all over the mustering hall, too. But auxiliaries? Where had they come from? Although I'd never gone through the process before, I knew that joining up with other legions and auxiliary cohorts was SOP for special missions. A full cohort of techs, for example, was useful when handling engineering projects or drone-based units. Bio cohorts were known to exist as well, on hand in case we were tasked with giving aid to an alien world with a rampaging pandemic. Our people were especially sought after under such circumstances, as humans couldn't catch a disease that had evolved to kill an alien form of life. Such missions were considered cakewalks, however, and I doubted Varus would be treated to any such easy task. From what Equestrian Nagata had indicated, this was going to be a rough campaign. "Then, can I ask?" I began, but Graves cut me off.
"No. Shut up, McGill."
He looked away from me and ran his eyes over the assembled unit.
"Now that we're up and flying, I can tell you our destination. We're going to Gamma Pavonis, a white F-class star a little larger than our own soul."
We looked from one to another, confused. I couldn't recall ever having heard of such a star before.
"That's right,"
Graves said, taking in our baffled looks.
"We're heading off the charts this time. This star is over 30 lights out from Earth in a new direction. To the best of our knowledge, we've never been there before. Let's join the Imperator's briefing channel."
Imperator Turov's face flashed up on the wall behind him. The entire wall was made up of photosensitive organic LEDs, and they made her image glow with life. This was the first time I'd seen Galina Turov's new, younger self magnified. She really was a sight for sore eyes. For about a minute, she fooled with her tapper. Finally, she looked up.
"Commanders," she said, "please signal the last few units that it's time to connect to my channel."
She looked down again, waiting. During this warm-up time, Natasha had been eyeing me rather than Turov. Natasha had been placed near me, as we were both specialists, and accordingly had been assigned to a front-row spot. I stared up at Imperator Turov expressionlessly. Sure, I wanted to smile about those lips which she'd glossed up. Each lip had to be thicker than a man's arm on that huge screen. But I didn't dare show interest. Natasha and I had an on-again, off-again thing going, and I knew that if she caught me grinning at Turov, I'd be in the off-again stage indefinitely.
"Do you think she's doing this on purpose?"
Natasha asked me.
"Doing what?"
Looking disgusted, she nodded toward the screen.
"Making us watch her. She has a captive audience of about 25,000 right now, and she's not even making a speech."
"Oh, that," I said. "I don't know. I'm kind of hungry. I could really use some breakfast about now." This was not total bullshit, but it was pretty close. I was hungry, but I could probably watch Turov's little pre-game show for another 10 minutes before I got bored with it. Finally, the Imperator got on with the briefing.
"Good morning, troops. I will attempt to answer all your questions at once with this briefing. We're moving out today, not as a hired mercenary band, but rather as an organized force representing Earth. Our contracts have been paid by Hegemony using galactic credits. I've been chosen to lead this campaign personally by my superiors because of my intimate knowledge of our true enemy."
Frowning, I absorbed her words. Our true enemy? She could only mean the squids.
"Renegade forces abound along the fringe of the Empire. Frontier 921, being at the edge of explored galactic space, naturally borders dangerous barbarians. One such untamed tribe calls itself the Kingdom of the Cephalopods."
I glanced at Natasha. She was frowning, too. We were both worried. I'd been holding out a thin hope we'd been assigned to one of those easy escort missions I'd heard so much about since I was a kid. Instead, this looked like we were marching to war. Real war. At least Natasha seemed to have gotten over the idea that Turov was flirting with everyone.
"The target world's atmosphere is somewhat similar to that of Earth. It's made up primarily of nitrogen, about 75%, with an oxygen content just under 10%. That's where the similarities end, however. The world's surface is made up of an icy frost of methane and bubbling petroleum byproducts. There are lakes and even small seas of liquid methane, but very little water."
"Sounds like a real garden," I said quietly.
"Sounds like an ice ball," Natasha said. "It must be if there's liquid methane."
"Sounds like you two need to learn when to shut the hell up,"
Harris said from behind us. We both straightened up and stared at the giant Turov on the forward wall.
"The surface temperature varies between -150 and -200°C,
she continued. I winced. An ice ball indeed.
"Interestingly," the giant face went on, "science tells us there might be some kind of life on this world, producing the oxygen in the atmosphere. If so, this life must be quite alien and subsist by using methane as a primary energy source. The cloud layer is so thick that photosynthesis, as we understand it, is probably impossible."
The world she was painting in my mind was an unpleasant one, frozen with deadly substances everywhere. The air might be breathable if we filtered it and warmed it up by a few hundred degrees, but that was about it.
"The reason we're interested in this planet is strategic," Turov continued. "Galactic intel tells us that the cephalopods are probing this world and may be building an advanced base there, as it's close to Empire space. Their strategic goals are easy to discern. The world is mineral-rich. Metals and radioactives are plentiful."
That made more sense to me. If the target world could be used to build ships and weapons right on the border, both sides would want the planet. Turov continued her lecture.
"If there is an indigenous population, it's probably primitive and negligible. We will arrive with 3 ships and 2 legions. Any cephalopod forces will be eliminated if they refuse to vacate the system."
This caused me a pang. Sure, the Nerbs had blown up one of their worlds when they'd attacked our ship, Corvus, and later, I'd personally had a hand in destroying their ship when they attacked a mega-hub full of Tau civilians on Tech World. But this was different. We'd be invading. Striking first. As far as the squids were concerned, I was pretty sure they figured this planet was theirs for the taking. Interfering with that using Earth's legions. Well, I hoped the hog brass knew what they were doing.
"On to the last item of today's agenda," Turov continued. "Legion Solstice, Legion Varus, I would like to introduce you to 2 new cohorts. They're both cavalry units from Zeta Herculis."
That got our attention. I hadn't known what to expect, but two cohorts of specialized troops from Zeta Herculis? That had to be damn near the bottom of the probability chart for me. Zeta Herculis, better known as Dust World, was Earth's one and only colony. We'd been allowed to keep it on a technicality. Normally, civilizations in the Empire were permitted to inhabit only a single star system. But since we'd colonized this lonely, dry planet back before the Empire had discovered us, we'd been grandfathered in.
These two auxiliary cohorts do include some colonial troops, Turov said. They'll be attached to your existing legions. Cross-training will take place on the third ship, Cyclops, as there's plenty of open space available on her decks.
I bet there is, I said quietly. Natasha's eyes snapped toward me, and I shut up immediately. Romance-wise, this might be yet another bad turn. I'd taken an interest in one of the colonists on Dust World years back. Her name was Della, and I'd probably never had a stranger relationship in my lifetime. Including Natasha and Turov, that made this a potential three-girl situation, and I'm simply not equipped to handle that kind of pressure.
I will now list off the units I want transferred to Cyclops for immediate cross-training.
Turov began to read off various unit designations from one cohort to another. Units from both Varus and Solstice were specified. There were quite a few of them. I finally noticed Natasha was staring at me. What? I asked her.
I know what you're thinking.
You do?
Yes. Don't play that dumb guy thing with me. You're thinking about Della.
Who? She made a disgusted sound.
Oh, yeah, Della,
I said, as if just recalling the name. That crazy colonist chick. Do you know she killed me twice back on Dust World?
Then why do you still want to see her?
I shook my head, baffled. Where's this coming from? I demanded. She's probably not even on that ship. I mean, what are the odds?
Pretty good. She was one of their top fighters.
Candidly, I had to agree with her, but there was no percentage in admitting that. I laughed quietly instead.
Natasha, get real. That girl is 50 lights away. And anyway, why do you care so much? Do you want to start going out with me again?
Certainly not.
I tried not to smile, but I failed. I knew she wanted to go out. Why the hell else would she care so much about the ghost of Della, someone who probably wasn't even...
Legion Varus, third cohort, third unit, Turov announced.
It could have been my imagination, but I thought maybe the Imperator had given the camera a little flickering smile as she listed my unit designation.
I don't believe it, Natasha said.
That bitch...
What's wrong? I asked. She said we'll train with auxiliary cavalry, right? That sounds pretty cool.
Not if it was her idea. Not if she picked us off the list for this special assignment. Didn't you see her smirk at the camera? We're doomed.
I shook my head. Natasha could be overly dramatic sometimes. Chapter 7. The flotilla dropped out of warp near an orange-looking K-class star system encircled by lifeless worlds. Before we went back into warp, my unit was transferred off Minotaur and onto Cyclops. The ships were all armed Imperial transports, so they looked pretty much the same. Cyclops had the same bulbous hull and a full broadside of 16 big guns for armament. The main hold of Cyclops was occupied by a stack of modules in the same manner as the other two ships. The number of modules was smaller, however, and they'd been pushed together to form a single mass about 3 modules high. On top of these modules was a wide, flat area about 1 kilometer square. My unit was brought in first before any other unit had transferred. Marching into the hold in a column 4 abreast, we exited the lifter's ramps and were ordered to climb up to the top of that stack of modules. We hustled, not wanting colonials to see us looking weak. We jogged up a set of steps made of steel tubing to the top. I noticed one thing along the way. The gravity was turned on full force. Usually while traveling in space, the transport ships maintained a centrifugal force of half gravity. That level was both heavy enough to keep us fit and light enough to make it easy to get around with heavy equipment. But today my body weighed over 100 kilos and my kit must have been twice that much. Fortunately, my exoskeletal armor helped out with the load. Once we stepped out on top of the modules, we were wowed by an unusual sight. Arrayed on this large, flat surface were long lines of fighting machines. I recognized them immediately.
"Hey," Carlo said, coming up to me with a broad grin. "I know those machines. Turov drove one of these babies when she snapped off your head back on Tech World."
"That's right, but as I recall, she killed you first with one snip."
"Whatever."
"These look bigger," I said, marveling and stepping toward them. "And improved." They were bigger. As we walked closer, we could see they were at least 3 meters tall. I bet when they stood up and were fully operational, they'd be even taller. When Turov had driven a suit like this, it had been little more than a heavy-built exoskeleton wrapped around her body. These machines were more leggy. I figured right off that the pilot's legs probably only went down to about the knee joint, while his hands terminated where the elbows were.
"They look like mean ostriches," Carlo said.
"No," I replied. "I'd say they're more like a small T-Rex. Ostriches don't have tails that whip around or big foreclaws."
"Good point. I bet getting yourself murdered by Turov while she was driving one of these suits turned you on, didn't it, McGill? You're sick."
"I'm not the one who can't stop talking about it."
"Come on, let's pick out our machine and start riding."
Carlos trotted toward the line of hulking metal vehicles. I walked after him, watching them warily. They all seemed unoccupied, but one could never be too... Up and down the line, about every 20th machine perked up when Carlos was about 100 meters away. Carlos's rapid approach faltered, then stopped altogether. He glanced back at me with a worried expression. Veteran Harris moved in front of the group. He was smiling, and right away I knew he was in on the surprise.
"They're quite something, aren't they?"
he asked, with his throat mic cranked up to top volume.
"Fantastic fighting machines. We call them dragons."
I walked to Carlos and slapped him.
"See? I told you they weren't ostriches."
He waved me away.
"I'm sorry to say," Harris continued, "that these fine dragons are about to be totally wasted on a unit of sorry shit sacks like you. I told them not to do it, but the brass never listens to me."
I said in concern. "Some of those suits are occupied, Vet. Who's in there?"
"Your trainers, Zeta Hercules people. Think of them as advisors."
"They built these things?" One of the machines started walking then. It stalked forward on its hind legs like a predatory bird. It flexed four claws that terminated in sharp grippers, and the tail moved on its own to balance the machine when it leaned and stepped. Twin stubby cannons were built into the barrel-like chest. Inside the dim-lit faceplate, I could make out the vaguest outline of a human face. We felt like little kids facing a Halloween monster. Reflexively, our line of troops fell back a few steps.
"We're here to train you in the proper use and maintenance of these systems," the pilot's voice boomed.
The amplified voice was kind of creepy coming out of the robotic fighting vehicle. It was as if some kind of mechanical nightmare was talking to us. None of the Varus people approached any closer. Harris grinned.
"Stand down, Scout," he said, then turned back to us. "Now, this is how we're going to do things today. We're going to have a little sparring contest. A full unit of Varus regulars up against..."
Already troops around me were shifting into a fighting stance. We were no strangers to surprise drills. Varus loved them. Unfortunately, they were often deadly to the troops getting surprised. A number of men around me unlimbered their rifles and dropped to the deck. Up and down the line of dragons, 9 more had started moving. This was pure Legion Varus, training on the fly. I took a half second to glance over my shoulder, just as I'd thought our officers were nowhere to be seen. Adjunct Leeson and Graves were no doubt sipping a cold one and watching this contest on a vid screen in the officers' mess by now. As a weaponeer, I knew I was critical to any chance my side had, to take out these machines. By my estimate, my Belcher was one of the few systems heavy enough to punch through the enemy armor. Accordingly, I threw myself flat and shot the nearest one in the leg. This seemed to take everyone by surprise. Harris was still talking, describing his contest, but I was done listening. It was me or the dragons, that's all I knew. The target machine took the hit, and for a second I thought it was going to stay up. But it didn't. The leg buckled and the machine went down on one knee, servos whining. Harris charged at me, shouting. "Hold!" he roared. "No guns! Neither side is supposed to damage!" The machine's rider seemed to take exception to my breaking of the rules. Smoothly, two cannons protruded from the chest cavity and barked. Harris was in a bad place at a bad time, right between me and the dragon I'd just crippled. He was hit in the back and blasted off his feet. He went into a tumble that finished up about 5 meters to my left. His eyes were as dead as boiled eggs, and his back was a smoking ruin. All up and down the Varus line, my fellows opened up, rattling fire at the line of active machines. The machines rocked back with the shock, then returned fire with their cannons. The weapons seemed to have short range but explosive power. If I had to guess, I'd say they were firing rocket-powered grenades of some kind.
"Hold your fire!" boomed a command in our headsets. It took me a second to recognize the voice of Centurion Graves.
Somehow Graves managed to cut through the confusion. A few more shots were popped off by both sides, but we lowered our weapons and stared at one another distrustfully. Three of the dragons were damaged, and at least 20 troopers were dead.
"No guns, no shields, no force blades,"
Centurion Graves' voice ordered in my headset.
"Both sides are to use only melee weapons. This is to be a hand-to-hand contest. Go!"
Reluctantly, I dropped my Belcher. The temptation to launch one more salvo was strong in me, but I managed to resist it.
"What are we going to do, McGill?"
Carlos shouted from nearby, breathing hard.
"We're going to have to get in close and take them apart by hand."
"Shit," he said,
and I had to agree with the sentiment.
"Those grippers, there's no way, this is a setup. We're supposed to get slaughtered."
All up and down the line, the Varus troops were forming up in knots. They had a grim look on their faces. The enemy line formed up as well, transforming into a wedge-shaped group of 7 functioning dragons. With all my heart, I wanted to extend my force blades and do battle. But I didn't. Instead, I advanced, and a knot of troops formed around me. Veteran Harris was down, as was Sargon. That left me as the senior non-com in my platoon. This was my chance, I decided, to show I could lead men if I had to.
"All right," I said. "Form up, spread out. We're going to have to..."
That was as far as I got. The enemy wedge charged. There weren't that many of them, but they were ferocious. They came on with those powerful legs churning. If I had to guess, I would say they could run twice as fast as a man. The wedge plowed right into a knot of troops to my left. They went down like bowling pins. Screams and roars sounded from both sides. Men struggled in their exoskeleton suits, but they couldn't compete in either strength or weight. The troops had out knives, but although they gouged the armor of the machines and even cracked a few faceplates, the squad was soon just a struggling mass under the crushing weight of the machines. It was already clear to me what the enemy was going to do. They'd charge each group of us as we formed up and break us, destroying us in detail. The leader was already rotating a predatory head, the dragon's tail lashing with a whining noise as it fought to maintain balance, standing on the backs of fallen troopers.
"Break apart," I ordered. "Squad, spread out. Their commander is looking for a target, and we don't want that to be us."
They did as I asked, separating and dispersing with rapid sidesteps in every direction.
"Good thinking, McGill," Carlos said. "Let these mechanical monsters wreck everyone else first. With any luck..."
"Shut up, I'm trying to think,"
I ordered, and for once in his life he did what he was told.
"Natasha," I asked, "can you do anything?"
"Like what?"
she demanded, breathing hard.
"I don't know, maybe you could remotely hack the dragons or something."
"Tried it. No go, McGill."
"Okay, plan B."
"They're charging again,"
Carlos shouted. The cavalry had chosen another group of victims by now, and they charged in tight formation. This squad of troops had retreated to the edge of the battlefield and stood with their backs to a 100-meter drop. The results were almost as bad as the first time. With one exception, the troops managed to push one of the dragons over the side. That gave me an idea.
Squad, follow me. Attack. Redirect all suit power to your legs.
Without explaining, I ran across the field toward the struggling knot of men and dragons. The Varus troops were losing, badly, but they weren't all dead yet. Using only grippers, the machines had to pretty much amputate limbs methodically to win. We crossed the intervening distance quickly, and powered suits we could run almost as fast as the machines could when we sent the full power of our exoskeletons to our legs.
"What the hell are we doing, McGill?"
Carlos shouted.
"Hit them, like a football tackle. Knock them over the edge, it's the only way."
"McGill is right,"
Keevy shouted somewhere behind me.
"Let's push them over the side."
The best part of the next minute, as I later looked back on it all, had to be when the enemy turned to see us coming. They had to be thinking, what the hell? But before they could react, we were on them. My boots were clanging on the metal roof of the modules with perfect powered rhythm. My face was a death's head snarl of rage. Lowering my shoulder, I crashed into the nearest dragon. The shock was tremendous. The vehicle was so massive, it was as if I'd just rammed myself into the bumper of my parents' family tram back home. The machine rocked, but didn't go down. The driver must have set himself for the impact. But then Carlos came in beside me and added his weight. Finally, the machine began to move. It was sliding, I realized, sliding on the bloody mess they'd made of the last squad, who now formed heaps of helpless dead on the ground. We struggled, grappling their legs and heaving. One machine went over the side, taking a howling trooper with it. They crashed to the bottom of the hold, and I dearly hoped the rider had died for his sins. Still, the contest was uneven. There were only 5 dragons left against 10 infantry. While we'd shoved and grunted and forced them back, they hadn't been idle. Those grippers reached out, snapping and snipping. Heads and arms were lying everywhere. 10 of us. We couldn't do it. I decided as the dragon Carlos and I were working on got a gripper on my left elbow that I'd do my damnedest and die well. My arm didn't come off right away as my weaponeer's armor was heavier than that of the average trooper. If I could just kill one more of them. Wham! I felt a slamming weight against my back. My despair had been premature. More men had arrived. Legion Varus troops, seeing our plan and seeing it was working, had charged from all around the battlefield. More and more of them joined in, adding their weight to ours. I couldn't see, I could barely hear. So much blood had splattered my crackled faceplate, and everyone was roaring in my ear so loudly I didn't even realize I was near the edge. Until I went over. There was a sick feeling at the final second. It was a moment without parallel when I realized I was falling through the air and crashing down to certain death. The dragon I'd been struggling with all this time was under me, and I was riding it down. It felt like I was falling all the way to hell itself. I don't remember hitting the bottom. I think I was knocked out at least for a few seconds. I came awake, groaning. I flipped my faceplate painfully and I could see again. A tangled mass of death lay all around me. One of the machines and 3 or 4 troopers squirmed, but most was still. On impulse, I reached up and opened the faceplate of the nearest machine, the one I'd ridden over the side. To my shock, I recognized the face inside.
"Della?"
I asked in a coughing whisper. She didn't answer me because she was as dead as a stone. I stared into her face. It was strange meeting up with her again. It was even stranger to know I'd just killed her. A cheer swelled louder and louder above me. I flopped and rolled onto my back, looking up. A line of Varus troops stood along the edge, shaking their fists and whooping.
"Look at McGill!" Carlos shouted. "He's still alive!"
More cheers went up, grinning through bloody teeth. I forced one gauntlet to wave at them before I passed out. Chapter 8. Bio people are lazy. They don't like to fix the bodies of the badly injured. They preferred to recycle broken flesh and start new. Theirs was a throwaway culture, and I was therefore surprised when I woke up in the infirmary in my old, badly damaged body.
7 broken bones, not counting ribs,
biospecialist Ann Grant read from her tapper while standing next to me. I had to turn my head pretty far to see her as my right eye had swollen shut.
Contusions, punctures, and a collapsed lung,
she went on.
We even had to remove your spleen. Do you know how long it's been since I've bothered to do that, James?
No, but I'm pretty sure you're going to tell me, I said with stinging, cracked lips.
8 years, I would guess. That's how long ago I signed up with this crazy outfit. We just don't do organ removal, not from a living person, that is.
Sounds like it would be boring, just running the revival machine all day. She gave me a reproachful look.
And you? You're hurting, aren't you? Is this better than a fresh revive?
I didn't know why she was giving me a hard time, but I was getting tired of it. After all, I was the one in agony. She'd only suffered inconvenience. Then again, maybe I was just feeling sorry for myself. Actually, I said, I'm feeling pretty good. I figured I might go for a jog around the top of those modules later today. I've got a few kinks in my legs I need to work out. She shook her head and huffed.
Those aren't kinks, they're staples. I new-skinned the hell out of them, but they'll sting for a week. They're sunk in all the way to the bone.
Groaning, I levered myself into a half-sitting position. Her small hands pushed on my chest.
Lie back down, please. You'll pass out if you get out of bed now. Graves wants to talk to you. I think that's why you're still alive.
I let her push me back down. In truth, it felt a lot better that way. I was a mess. As a person who's been killed and injured countless times, I could tell this was a bad one. Graves showed up about 10 minutes later. His face blocked out the medical lights that were glaring into my eyes, and he examined me with all the tenderness of a rancher poking at his prized bull.
Miguel, are you lucid yet?
Right as rain, sir.
Good. I wanted to talk to you. With all the revives going on today, I knew it would be a while if I let you stack up in the queue with the rest. I hope you don't mind.
Mind that you stop me from being recycled? No, sir. I don't mind.
He slapped my thigh and I winced. He didn't seem to notice. That's the spirit. I want to thank you, Miguel. That was a fine bit of improvising you did out there on the field today. We didn't expect that play. Sure, Winslade and the rest of his auxiliary people are screaming about the damage you did to their machines. But you know what I said to that?
What, sir?
That they could go screw themselves, that's what. It was Winslade's idea to prove how powerful his machines were by abusing all the new troops who arrived to train on them. I'm sure he didn't expect much in the way of damage, but that's just too damn bad.
I was fuzzy, but I was pretty sure he'd mentioned a name that I didn't think should be mentioned when talking about combat units.
Sir?
I asked. Did you say Winslade? As in Adjunct Winslade?
The one and only. Turov's sidekick has finally cashed in his marker. He's a primus now, hadn't you heard?
A primus was in charge of a cohort in a regular legion, or in some cases, an independent auxiliary cohort. Commanding an auxiliary cohort gave a primus more prestige and responsibility than a regular commander who was permanently the subordinate of a legion's tribune. Usually, such special cohort assignments went to people who'd held rank of primus for several years, and who had done well in that capacity. Winslade was none of these.
I'm not surprised he managed to swing a command rank, I said. But isn't this a stretch? A primus is 2 jumps above an adjunct. Last I'd heard, he still didn't have much in the way of combat experience to begin with.
I know,
Graves said.
I know. I've been with this legion for decades, and they've always promoted one snot-nose or another over me. That's the way of things sometimes. When forming up a new auxiliary cohort, you would think they'd look for officers from the existing fighting forces, but no.
They took and promoted a hog right over you. It's just not right.
Well, let's forget about that,
Graves said.
Let's talk about your tactics.
What inspired you to try to shove the dragons over the side? I explained how I'd seen a group along the edge which had managed to throw one down. I then quickly ordered my followers to charge into the melee before the dragons could finish butchering the first group.
Excellent, Graves said. That's what I'm talking about right there. Leadership on the field, improvisation, and victory. I don't regret a thing.
I frowned. What would you have to regret, sir?
Your upcoming trials have been challenged. The 3rd Unit veterans came to me, and they told me I had to pull your advancement to candidacy. Did you know they were against it?
I had a feeling, sir.
Well, I won't lie. This might go badly for you, but I think you might be able to pull it off somehow. See you on the other side, McGill.
He stood up and gave a grim nod. Then he left the infirmary. I looked after him and tried not to worry. The trip out to Gamma Pavonis was a long one. I had plenty of time to heal up and join in the training exercises with the rest of my unit. Driving the dragons around turned out to be fun. I'd seen Turov do it back on Tech World, but at that time I hadn't known who had built these machines. Apparently the colonists from Dust World had produced the prototypes when seeking a system they could sell to other planets. They'd settle down as nanite vendors in the end, but not before producing some pretty interesting designs to share with the human-only market. What got me most was the inventiveness of the colonists on Dust World. They'd been a splinter group cut off from Earth for nearly a century. They hadn't known they shouldn't be making new tech devices freely, that it was against galactic law. What impressed me the most, however, was how many cool things they'd invented with such a small group. During the same interval, Earth had pretty much stagnated technologically. Due to its very nature, the Empire progressed very slowly. I recalled from my new history courses back in school that the 20th and 21st centuries had been a time of explosive growth in human knowledge. We'd invented all kinds of things that were taken for granted today. Humanity had been quite innovative back in the days before the galactic bureaucrats came and put a damper on all our creativity. In order to legally make a product in the Empire, you had to first make sure that no other civilization held the patent. The colonists from Zeta Herculis hadn't known about these restrictions, and had plowed along inventing whatever they damn well pleased. I had to admire their spunk. The dragons were one such invention. As they were already producing nanites as a trade good to cement their position in the Empire, they decided to use the battle vehicles as a trade good with Earth itself. It was just as illegal for a single planet to have multiple interstellar trade goods as it was to have none or to trade something that someone else did. But apparently, no other planets produced suits like these, and so humans were in the clear to build and sell them among themselves. Over the next month or so, I'd come to understand how the new auxiliary cohort fit in with the rest of Legion Varus. My Legion had gone into space this time with a lot of extra recruits. These troops now served to swell the ranks of all 10 of Varus's existing cohorts. In the meantime, veteran troops were moved into the new auxiliary cohort. My unit, being one of the ones trained in the use of heavy armor, was a natural choice to learn how to fight in dragons, as they were essentially larger, heavier, self-powered battle armor systems. Centurion Graves became a unit commander under Winslade. It seemed unfair, even downright mean, to put him in that position. But Turov had never been one to worry about justice when she made a decision. And so, I learned how to drive the strange dragons. Probably the most difficult part was learning how to operate the hand controls manipulating the grippers at the same time I was directing the twin chest cannons. The chest cannons operated in two modes. You could use them on full auto, which essentially meant the suit's computer system chose its target and fired the cannons wherever it wanted to. Or you could manually control both the arms and the cannons with your own hands. This was accomplished by squeezing metal triggers with your palms and 3 smaller fingers, while at the same time using your thumb and forefinger to make pinching motions to control the grippers. In reality, Most troopers chose the middle ground of letting the computer aim the cannons, while they chose the moment to fire by either verbally commanding it or by using their fingers. It was all pretty much as difficult as it sounded. I remarked about it to Carlos while we were undergoing our final trials.
"Tell me about it," Carlos said. "I feel like I should have a bugle hanging out of my ass. I'm a one-man band here."
Throughout the days of training, I was naturally in close proximity with Della. We were both riding dragons, of course, but I could still see her face. I had to wonder what she was thinking. I knew without asking what Natasha was thinking. She didn't leave me any mystery about it. Every time I looked at Della or watched her climb in and out of her dragon, Natasha seemed to notice. I didn't know how I was supposed to avoid noticing Della all the time, so I didn't bother to try. After all, we took showers together, dressed together, and sparred together all day long. Since Natasha seemed to care so much, I decided to make a play for her at dinner the night before we finished our training.
"Natasha," I said, "hey, how about you and I..."
"Forget it,"
she snapped.
"What? You haven't heard what I was going to say?"
"James, I've heard it all. We all have. All of the women in this unit."
"Sheesh. I was just gonna..."
"I know. I suggest you go ask Della instead."
"Wait," I said. "Della doesn't even look at me. Haven't you noticed that?"
"Of course I have. That's why I'm angry. She's still very aware of you. Go talk to her. She wants you to."
I shrugged. "Fine. Just fine. I'll do that." I found Della in the colonist module, which was in the lowest tier of the stack aboard Cyclops.
"Hi, Della," I said. "I thought I'd come down here and..."
Della put a finger to her lips. She walked toward me, smiling. When she came close, I checked her hands for weapons, and I became alarmed. She had one hand behind her back. Like I said, Della and I had a strange relationship. We'd made love and fought to the death about the same number of times. It could go either way with this woman. When she got close, I backed up a little. Laughing, she lifted both her hands, palms out. They were empty. I smiled sheepishly.
"Just checking," I said.
"I know," she said, "but I've changed, James."
"Listen," I said hesitantly, "I wanted to apologize for pushing you off the stack of modules and killing you the other day. I didn't know it was you inside that metal monster at the time. You understand that, right?"
"Yes. You shouldn't feel any remorse. After all, I did know it was you, and I still tried to clip your arms off. It was all part of the exercise."
"No hard feelings, then?"
"None at all."
I smiled. "Good. We can be friends again. Say, how about..." That was as far as I got. She cut off my words by jumping on me. That's the only way I can describe it. One second I was unsure how I stood, even fearing for my life, and the next we were in a lip lock. We found a place off by ourselves on the green deck, which was pretty easy to do on Cyclops, since the ship had only about 20% of the usual number of troops aboard. Green deck was like a public park, a place traditionally built aboard all large ships to simulate an outdoor environment. It was always popular with couples seeking a getaway during off hours. During the day, it was used for combat training. Overgrown with trees and riddled with sheltered nooks, behind rocks and bushes, there was always a spot you could find that was secluded and at least semi-private. Artificial birds sang and brooks babbled, giving people the exact level of cover noise they needed. We made love, and the sex was as good as it had always been with Della. She was possibly the most uninhibited girl I'd ever been with. I chalked that up to her upbringing on an alien world.
"That was great," I said afterward. "You aren't still trying to get pregnant, are you?"
"No, of course not," she said. "I wouldn't do that now. It wouldn't be appropriate."
I sighed in relief. Last time we'd been together, Della had been interested in procreating with me. Apparently that was all over with. Putting my arms behind my head, I stretched out on the grass and stared up at the simulated starry sky.
"Aren't you interested?"
she asked. "Interested in what?"
Don't you at least want to know the name I chose?
I frowned in confusion. What are you talking about, girl?
Our child, of course.
Words failed me. You mean...
Of course. We succeeded the last time. Her name is Etta.
I stared at her. Both of my eyes must have been as big around as a Georgia peach. She laughed at me, laughed right in my face. I jumped up like I'd been stung.
What are you doing out here in space? I demanded. Where's our kid? You didn't bring her aboard, did you? No, I wouldn't do that. She's far too young. She'll make an excellent scout someday, but she's not ready yet.
No, I didn't mean that. Who's taking care of her? That's what I want to know.
Her grandfather, among others. You remember the principal investigator.
I made a sour face. How could I forget?
Don't worry, Della said. Etta will be fine. With your genes and mine, she's as immutable as a stone in the desert. Everything will make way for her. Nothing will break her.
But, listen, where I come from, parents care for their own children directly. If I'd had a kid back on Earth, I wouldn't have joined the legions and come flying out here to the stars. I would have stayed home and raised it. She cocked her head to one side and looked at me quizzically.
Are you upset?
A little, yeah, I admitted.
You didn't enjoy the sex?
I snorted. Of course I did. She shook her head and combed leaves out of her hair with her fingers.
You people from Earth, you're so sensitive. You worry about everything. How can life be worth living if you worry all the time?
If there's one thing I'd never been called before, it was a worrier. But this was different. Della had gone and gotten herself pregnant, with my help, of course, and now I'd been placed in an unaccustomed role of responsibility. It was a shock. Heaving a sigh, I sat down beside Della, and I looked her straight in the eye. We should get married, I said. She frowned. She plucked at the grass around her knees and twisted the blades around her fingers.
I would have liked that, she said. A year or so back. But I can't now.
Why not? She smiled at me. Her expression was almost shy.
Because, James, I'm already married.
Chapter 9. Della's twin revelations came as quite a shock to me. Not only was I a father, the parent of a kid I'd never seen and possibly never would see, but she'd gone and gotten married in the meantime. Even stranger was her apparent attitude toward fidelity. I mean, she was a married woman, and yet she'd slept with me without even telling me about it. I just couldn't get over that. Culturally, we were about as far apart as two people could get. Needless to say, I was confused. I went back to my bunk that night and thought about it, unable to sleep for nearly 10 minutes. That's not normal for me. When I finally did fall asleep, I dreamt weird things. I dreamt about squids and deserts and beautiful, nutty women. Around about 3 in the morning, my sleep was interrupted. Straps looped over my chest, legs, and throat. My eyes snapped open, and I moved to get out of bed, but I was pinned down to it. The room was dark, and my roommates were gone. Figures stood all around me. As an experienced fighting man from Legion Varus, I pride myself on being prepared for violent action at all times. This was just one more of those times. My right hand slid out of the grasp of the man who was trying to pin it down. I managed this trick with the aid of the combat knife my parents had given me some time back. Knives in my time were sharper than they had been in the past. Using advanced metallurgical techniques and molecular alignments, a knife could be made to cut through flesh and bone as easily as paper. One could even puncture steel plate if driven with sufficient force. But of course, before that could happen, the owner of the knife had to be a man paranoid enough to sleep with such a weapon in his grasp. I happened to be just such a man. Fingers, straps, blankets, they all parted before the glittering white line of my knife's edge. One of my assailants started howling. He also released his grip on my forearm. My blade flashed up to the man holding a strap around my neck. This guy was quicker, however, and he managed to get his two hands around my wrist before I could drive the point of my blade into his face.
"Damn it, McGill!"
Harris hissed.
"Stop struggling. This is the beginning of your trial."
"Sorry, vet," I said. Someone snapped on the lights. I looked around at the